Greetings and retrophytic Junipatians, my vituperously psychophilic listeners, and welcome to this June 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this unremarkably mandaritic science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Tonight, part two of Adventures in Sleep Apnea, Revenge of the CPAP Machine. So, after being officially diagnosed with sleep apnea, I was told that insurance would pay for the use of a CPAP machine. Well, mostly pay. But the deal seemed okay to me. So what is a CPAP machine? Well, not only did my pulmonary specialist call it the gold standard in all of sleep apnea treatment, it is also the most ingenious and subtle torture device ever devised. And I do use the word subtle in a seriously ironic tone, as you shall see. A CPAP machine, by official definition, which I did not appreciate at all until putting it over my face, is a continuous positive airway pressure device. The machine pushes air into your airways continuously to ensure that they do not collapse when you are sleeping. The newest machine can actually change its air pressure and make it greater or lesser throughout the night to correspond to your breathing, or lack thereof. So pressure reduces as your breathing is more normal and increases when it's less normal or stops. Sounds simple, huh? When I spoke to the nurse on the way out to make an appointment for the technician to drop this wondrous machine off at my home and explain its care and use, I had another amazing conversation, which went a bit like this. By the way, if you have read the book Wayward Pines or seen the TV show, you will immediately be reminded of the sadistic nurse Pam.
Mr. Campanella, you'd better use this machine.
Excuse me, ma'am? Better use it?
Yes, or you'll lose it.
I don't understand. How will anybody even know if I'm using it or not?
Two ways,
she says, and then stops. I have to encourage her to get more. Yeah, could you explain?
The CPAP machine has Wi-Fi.
What? Why would a breathing machine have Wi-Fi? And what is it transmitting?
It's transmitting to the medical supply company, who then send the information to your insurance carrier. It's telling them whether you're using the machine for at least 6 hours a night, and everything about your sleep patterns.
6 hours a night? What if the Wi-Fi signal were blocked for some reason? I'm already thinking of putting the bloody CPAP into a Faraday cage to block off its signals.
Oh, that doesn't matter. There's a memory card in the machine that records its every use, and how much you sleep, and how well it's working, and if it needs adjustments. Oh, and lots more information besides. And you have to send the memory card into the company after 3 months.
Isn't all this an invasion of my privacy? I get a shrug and answer.
You want the CPAP machine? That's the price of it.
Okay, so what happens if I don't use it?
Simple. They'll take it away and you'll never get another one.
Okay, thanks for the info, Nurse Ratchet. So, several days later, the sleep technician showed up at my house in the middle of dinner. Well, they did say he'd be there between 4 and 7, the perfect time for less than social interactions after a hard day of work. I asked if he could just give us a few minutes to finish up and clean up from dinner, but he made it clear. An appointment was an appointment, and anyway, he wanted to get home to dinner, and I was his last appointment of the day. So he pulls out this compact but complex pump device and plops it down on our counter, attaches a hose to it, and starts to explain its use in cleaning to me. Finally, he asks what kind of mask I want. And I've been thinking about this. So I tell him the full face mask, because I breathe through my mouth while asleep, and the full face mask might help to reduce problems with that. So I slip it over my face, and I feel a gentle breeze pushing up into my mouth and nose. Oh, well, that's nice. Almost soothing. Pleasant.
Ah!
What the blazes was that? I scream, pulling off the mask. I gasp for breath as a rushing wind, like something from a Category 5 hurricane or a Dyson vacuum cleaner, was assaulting me. And the tech shrugs. I just turned it on. What do you mean you turned it on? I thought it was on. What was that gentle, soft air coming through? Oh, that was just the background cooling system. That was not the machine. Oh, no. Okay, fine. Well, then we'll just have to turn it down to a lower setting. I can't breathe through my mouth and nose when so much air is coming through. I was hyperventilating. No. No what? No, you can't turn it down. That's the lowest setting. Pull. No. 4 PSI, lowest setting. That makes no sense. Why start at that level when it will just adjust and go up as the night goes on anyway? Because 4 PSI has been determined to be the lowest pressure that is therapeutically beneficial. But why have it at 4 PSI while I'm still awake and trying to fall asleep? Why not ramp up from a comfortable 1 PSI or below 1 PSI? I mean, remember, the disease is called sleep apnea. I need to fall asleep first before the machine can help. Hey, it is what it is. I can't do nothing about it. You want to try a different mask? Sure, I guess. This one just goes over the nose. Ha! You look like an elephant with that mask and tube on, Dad! Roars my son with laughter. I shoo him away. I don't care what I look like. I just want a good night's sleep. And that is looking more and more unlikely at this point. The tech turns the machine on again. It's not quite so traumatic this time, since the vacuum cleaner load of air is just being pushed up my nose. I can still kind of gasp through my mouth, sounding like a beached porpoise. Is that better? Asked the tech. Oh, loads, I say, gasping. He misses a sarcastic tone entirely, or is maybe just ignoring it. Excellent. Then I guess you're going to be keeping it. What choice do I have, I mutter. Now I am left alone with the bloody machine. So as with any machine that is being used at home in a medically therapeutic fashion, this machine has no access to controls for you to adjust it. But I'm a hacker at heart. I immediately go to the web and look up the model number of the machine to find out how to get access to the actual controls on the thing. And after 5 minutes, I have it. Press this button, hold it down for 5 seconds, press this other button, and there is the doctor's menu. Excellent. And what do I discover when I look at the maximum and minimum pressures? First, I find out that 4 PSI actually is the lowest setting. The moron engineers who made this thing actually did not even consider allowing it to ramp up from something lower. The second thing I discover is that my doctor had the highest pressure of the night set at 20 PSI. That is close to the pressure of the tires on your car. Imagine that blowing up your nose at 3 a.m., folks. I thought 4 PSI was completely nuts. What would 5 times that pressure be like? Well, it was moot, because I have yet to find out. Listeners, I can't do it. I cannot get used to being blasted in the face with air while I am trying to fall asleep. It is quite literally a torture for me. Imagine somebody poking you continually as you try to fall asleep, and you will begin to feel my anguish. As far as I'm concerned, the cure is worse than the disease at this point. Okay, yes, I can hear some of you gasping out there who have shown such concern over my health. I'm not giving up. I am not thrilled with sleep apnea either. I am doing several things which have been shown to be effective to ameliorate my problem. First, I will lose weight. I'm not hugely rotund, but I do need to lose probably 40 pounds. This will alter the morphology of my throat, and presumably it will be less likely to collapse during sleep. I have not been hugely motivated to lose weight until this point, but I guess now I have no choice. Second, I'm signing up at my wife's gym to get more exercise in during the week. This will help me to lose weight. Additionally, heavy exercise has been shown to reduce our need for sleep. Finally, I'm going to do one thing that's based on a research paper that I found in the literature. And yes, this is the first science-y story of the night, although it is several years old at this point. The paper is from 2010 from the journal Anesthesiology. It comes out of the lab of Yugo Taigato at Teikyo University, Chiba Medical Center in Japan. Taigato, who is an anesthesiologist, found that many of his patients with sleep apnea had lots of trouble breathing after surgery and before they woke up. He wanted to, quote, prevent reversal of pharyngeal airway obstruction in anesthetized patients with sleep apnea, unquote. He basically stated that this is a significant task assigned to anesthesiologists who are responsible for patient safety during post-operative periods. The solution was to test breathing of such patients after sitting them up at various angles in hospital beds. He stated that no study had ever assessed postural changes of pharyngeal airway dimensions during sleep and anesthesia. In short, nobody had looked at how sitting posture could affect sleep apnea. His group evaluated structural properties of each pharyngeal segment independently and successfully applied the methodology for assessing influences of various mechanical interventions on pharyngeal airway opening under general anesthesia and after operations when the general anesthesia was wearing off. They then compared static pharyngeal mechanics of the passive pharynx during lying down in a supine position to those during sitting postures, various sitting postures, of patients with sleep apnea. And essentially, they found that the postural changes from supine to sitting enlarged both the retropalatal and retroglossal airways and decreased pressures at both the pharyngeal segments at approximately 6 centimeters of water in patients with sleep apnea. Their results clearly demonstrate that structural properties of the passive pharynx improve while patients are in the sitting position, and they did not need to be completely sitting up. A 30% incline upwards from being on their backs actually helps significantly. What's the upshot of all this? Well, you can actually ameliorate breathing in someone with sleep apnea if they are not flat on their backs. Is this a cure? No. Will this help everyone? No, probably not. However, at least for me, I will be taking more naps in my big easy chair sitting up. Does this work for me? Maybe. I still snore, but my lovely wife says that when I am napping in my chair, she has not noticed my breathing interrupted. After all that, let me make this caveat. Just because the CPAP machine is a horror show for me, do not let me deter anyone from trying it themselves. You may not have the aversion to the thing that I do, so do not give up on it before you've even tried it. Thousands of people have found sleep relief with this machine. I am probably one of the few who fall at the edges of the bell curve. I have always been very sensitive to the conditions under which I fall asleep. Right temperature, humidity, bedclothes, etc. If you have sleep apnea, try the CPAP. Do not throw up your hands based on my very biased advice. Okay, here's the first actual story of the night. There have been 4 new elements in the periodic chart that have had no names for the last few years. And ta-da! Well, now those 4 new elements have names. In December, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry officially recognized the discovery of elements 113, 115, 117, and 118, filling out the 7th row of the periodic table. As is traditional in chemistry, the naming rights go to the discoverers. Scientists at Riken in Wako, Japan, named element 113, and a Russian-US collaboration named the others. Element names have to follow certain rules, and that means no element McElement face. Seriously, children, Boaty McBoatface? Come on. Anyway, in line with those conventions, the proposed names for the 4 elements are derived from scientist names and geographical locations of research institutes. After a 5-month public review period and approval by IUPAC, the names will become official. Element 113 has been dubbed Nihonium, and will sport the chemical symbol NH. The name comes from the Japanese word Nihon, or Land of the Rising Sun, the actual name for Japan. Element 115 will receive the moniker Muscovium, shortened to MC, after the Moscow region, home to the Joint Institute for Nuclear Research in Dubna, where the element was discovered in collaboration with researchers at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Oak Ridge Lab in Tennessee will also get a periodic table shout-out. The proposed name for element 117 is Tennessine, after the home state of Oak Ridge, Vanderbilt University, and the University of Tennessee. It will bear the symbol TS. Finally, the element 118 will be named Organesson, or OG, after Russian physicist Yuri Organessian, who contributed to the discovery of, well, several super-heavy elements. Next story. Much as I think it stinks, I fall into the category of the next story. And what is that? Well, apparently, one-third of the world's population can no longer see the Milky Way. I know the last time I saw it, I was in the Big Island of Hawaii last year. And even when I was in Peru earlier this year, I never saw the Milky Way. Certainly, Lima is a massive city with a great many lights. But scarily, even in northern Peru, in the mountains, in the relatively small town of Huaraz, in the Andes, there was enough light to efficiently block sky viewing. Where I live normally in northeastern New Jersey, 30 miles from New York City, you are lucky if you can see any stars at all, let alone the Milky Way. For more than a third of the Earth's population, the glare of artificial lights conceals this cosmic wonder from view. Dr. Fabio Falchi and his colleagues reported all this in the June issue of the journal Science Advances. They estimate nearly 80% of North Americans and 60% of Europeans can no longer see the galactic core at night. Using a combination of satellite measurements and on-the-ground observation, Falchi assembled the first global atlas of artificial sky luminance, recording light pollution from everything from streetlights to spotlights. Nearly 4 in 5 people worldwide live under light-polluted skies, the atlas reveals. Singapore boasts the brightest nights, with skies so luminous that no one living in Singapore can actually fully adapt to night vision. Nights are darkest in Chad, the Central African Republic, and Madagascar, where more than 3/4 of the inhabitants can gaze up at the stars under pristine viewing conditions. There was no mention in the article of New Jersey, but then again, I suspect we fall into that 80% of Americans who can no longer see the heavens. Sticking with space for the next story, well, sort of, scientists examine the quantum properties of photons sent to space and back again. Dr. Paolo Villoresi of the University of Padua and his team reported in the newest issue of Physical Review Letters that they beamed blips of light up to a satellite that reflected them back to Earth. When the photons returned, they observed a property known as quantum interference. That confirmed that the particle's quantum trace remained intact over that 5,000-kilometer space voyage. The technique could one day lead to quantum cryptography by satellite, allowing users to send Snoop-proof encryption keys for encoding secret information. Villoresi says, quote, "It's important for the sake of secure communication and the advancement of physics, but honestly, I think it's just plain cool," unquote. Quantum interference is a fact of life for retarding particles like photons. Just like ripples in a pond can interfere with one another, increasing or decreasing in height as they collide, quantum particles, which have wave-like properties, can interfere with themselves. This interference amplifies or diminishes the probability that a particle will appear at a particular time or place. Why is this abstruse stuff important? Answer, the new result indicates that quantum communication can work outside of pristine laboratory environments. Next story. Can copper be the answer to our dieting prayers? Maybe. A freshly minted study from the lab of Dr. Christopher Chang in the journal Nature Chemical Biology indicates that copper could help restore a natural way to burn fat. Copper, it turns out, can alter the balance of metabolic accounts through its influence on a biochemical signaling pathway. Chang of Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory says, quote, using a mouse model of genetic copper misregulation in combination with pharmacological alterations in copper status and imaging studies, we found that copper regulates lipolysis, that's the breakdown of fat, at the level of the second messenger cyclic AMP, by altering the activity of the cyclic AMP degrading phosphodiesterase, PDE3B, unquote. To establish a fat-copper link, Chang used mice with a genetic mutation that causes them to accumulate copper in their livers. And these mice have larger than average deposits of fat compared to normal mice. The altered mice essentially were a model for a human condition known as Wilson's disease, which is potentially fatal if left untreated. Analysis of the altered mice revealed that the abnormal buildup of copper was accompanied by lower than normal lipid levels in the liver compared with control mice. Researchers also found that the white fat of the altered mice had lower levels of copper compared with the control mice and correspondingly higher levels of fat. They then treated the altered mice with isoproterenol, a beta agonist known to induce the breakdown of fat into fatty acids through the cyclic AMP signaling pathway. They noted that the altered mice exhibited less fat breakdown activity compared to control mice. Chang then conducted cell culture analyses to clarify the mechanism by which the copper influences fat degradation. And he found that the copper binds to phosphodiesterase 3, and that's an enzyme that binds to cyclic AMP, halting its ability to facilitate the breakdown of fat. So you've got cyclic AMP, which breaks down fat, and you've got phosphodiesterase 3, which binds the cyclic AMP and halts its activity. Chang says, quote, when copper binds to phosphodiesterase, it's like a brake on a brake. That's why copper has a positive correlation with fat breakdown. We find that copper is essential for breaking down fat cells so that they can be used for energy. The more copper there is, the more fat is broken down. We think it would be worthwhile to study whether a deficiency in this nutrient could be linked to obesity and obesity-related diseases, unquote. Please, please, this is important. Do not go crazy taking copper pills. Chang cautions against ingesting copper supplements as a result of this study. Too much copper can lead to imbalances with other minerals like zinc. He finishes with, quote, copper is not something the body can make, so we need to get it into our diet. The typical American diet, however, does not include many green leafy vegetables. Asian diets, for example, have many more foods that are rich in copper, unquote. Okay, the final story of the night. Well, it's about sex, naturally. Well, all right, sort of about sex. Well, kind of. I still suggest that if you have any young kiddies listening, you may want to stop now and listen later. This little discussion is really PG-13, not really R-rated. Dr. Yi Zhu of the University College of London says that the actual way that a voice sounds can lure women. He says that there are certain epitomized voice traits that suggest an attractive male. In a recent study in the journal Plus One, he analyzed the relationship between voice sound and what is attractive to the listener of the opposite sex. The results of Zhu's study suggest that the content of speech isn't everything. The voice itself carries information about the attractiveness of the speaker. Zhu says, quote, earlier studies by Susan Hughes of Albright College reported more than a decade ago that appealing voices correlate with a more V-shaped upper body in men and a more hourglass shape in women. Raters in her studies were able to decipher sex-specific body configurations of others simply by hearing a voice. Well, we've all got our biases, Is it likely that the owner of this voice is 5'4" and 140 pounds?
I provide you with enhancement for your romantic evening. I don't want to disturb your thoughts. I don't want to disturb your mood. I try to. That's why my songs are so long.
Or is it likely that the owner of this voice is 6'4" and 220 pounds?
Hello, this is Mike Tyson. I'm always, all my years as a young kid coming from the poorest neighborhoods in New York City, I never understood.
Well, okay, there are exceptions. Another recent study in the journal Trends in Cognitive Science from the lab of Katarzyna Pisanski at the University of Sussex suggests less attention has been paid to body size and specific acoustic parameters. That is, what are the components of the voice that communicate its appearance? Pisanski recorded the voices of 700 people from Germany, Canada, and the UK as they spoke a series of vowels. By getting rid of the words, this allowed the researchers to isolate the voice's acoustics specifically, including pitch, formants, and the elements of unevenness in voice called jitter and shimmer. I guess the more of either of those, the rougher or raspier the voice becomes. And then they observed how well these vocal aspects correlated with height, waist-to-hip, and chest-to-hip ratios, body mass index, and, well, other indicators of appearance. Pisanski says, quote, "We found a more complex story than what we would have thought," unquote. Certain vocal features predicted body size and shape. Formants, which are measurements of resonance, are determined by the length of a speaker's vocal tract. And Pisanski found that they were also the best correlates of a person's height and weight. That is, longer vocal tract lengths, which lead to a more resonant voice, were more likely among taller and heavier individuals. A lower waist-to-hip ratio among women, as well as a higher chest-to-hip ratio among men, was also linked to higher levels of vocal perturbation or roughness, what they called jitter and shimmer. This means that women with more masculine body shapes have smoother voices. Pisanski says, quote, "This could hypothetically be due to relatively high levels of testosterone among these women," unquote. Overall, there were more vocal correlates of women's body proportions than men's. Given the nature of the study, it's impossible to explain why it was easier to predict women's proportions from voice, but Pisanski suspects it has to do with natural selection and communicating reproductive fitness. She says, quote, "In terms of what we know about the importance of women's body shape, it would make more sense to have more information on height in men's voices and body shape in women's voices," unquote. This is all very interesting. I suspect that hormones have a lot to do with how the voice develops. I mean, for example, higher testosterone is known to affect vocal cord development during puberty, and it's also related to lower pitch in men's voices. Zhu says, "The trouble with trying to predict body size or shape from voice is that, quote, everybody is trying to cheat. We are all trying to project the ideal physique. And mostly unintentionally, our voices can lie. A short man can have a deep voice, while a woman with a boxy torso may be high-pitched and breathy," unquote. Zhu says some of this may be influenced by society and how we learn to speak, but cheating is mainly due to physiology, such as the short man getting a heavy dose of testosterone during puberty, which would help to lengthen his vocal cords and deepen his pitch. That's why the correlation between body shape and vocal parameters, even for the best ones, can be kind of low. Zhu finishes his article with, quote, "All of these weak correlations between body shape and voice really raise the question of why we've evolved to pay attention to these things as strong indicators of body size, even though they're weak indicators," unquote. I suspect it's because we believe they are good indicators. You can change your voice. Zhu is absolutely correct. If you do it unconsciously, you could do an even better job consciously. I have known a couple of transgender individuals in my life, and they worked extraordinarily hard on their female voices, though they were born male. Based on voice, I would dare anybody to identify them as anything but natural females. They spent years getting pitch and breathiness and rhythm down until they sounded absolutely normal and no less feminine than your wife or mother. And no, not like RuPaul or like a drag queen. So, as humans, we have been programmed to believe what we hear in a voice. And we constantly make judgment calls on what has been programmed into us by evolution. Sometimes we're right, and well, sometimes we're just plain wrong. That's all for me for now. As always, take care. Remember, do not go crazy with copper supplements. Give CPAP a chance. Voices aren't always honest. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.